If I missed a shaking hand or a falter in his smile, then that was that, and I couldn't revisit it. But in written form, he was under a bell jar and would stay there until my analyses were complete. Of course, he had me under one as well, but I chose my phrasing carefully and knew it would stand up to scrutiny. Really, it was a shame we had bodies. I wrote, "I miss having sex with you, but only because I have a body. And if I didn't, then everything would be easier." He replied that on the contrary, he suspected sex without bodies might pose challenges. Sunday mornings were Saturday for him. His papers came as usual. I laid them on the coffee table, read the headlines, and fidgeted with my watch. He'd left some shirts behind that I still hadn't ironed. The creases seemed like his, though I knew they were the washing machine's. I watched movies in his bed. This was, in theory, no different to doing so in my own, but I found it more immersive. Sometimes he rang on the weekend, but more often he messaged. Like me, he seemed to find it easier to express himself behind a screen. The Saturday after my theatre date with Edith, he wrote,
"Feel we may have parted on bad terms. Suboptimal terms, certainly. Hope you're keeping up with Miles, Victoria, Ralph, pronounced Rafe, etc. It's mental here. The garçon, absolute, still too principled to want to win elections, which is splendid now Tories have called one. And Bank of England says we're not doing enough to prepare for no deal. So between May grabbing Damocles by the sword and the rest of us stocking up on canned beans, London is, as ever, a haven of quietude. Interesting how pitch has changed from take back control to we think there will still be food. Anyway, say if you need anything. Sorry for uncertainty, re when back. J."
An editor could have fun, I thought, going through his messages and changing the full stops to exclamation marks. I didn't tell him about my evening with Edith. What couldn't be bothering him with every tiny detail? A fortnight after we met, Edith had theatre tickets again. This time she asked me first, and then the next week too. I didn't tell Victoria. I hoped the longer I left it, the more dudgeon it would cause her. I liked dudgeoning Victoria. And it was private, all of it, listening to the pinnacles and spires of her accent, sizing our proportions, feeling with each play like I was more and more someone Edith would be friends with. After the first play, I'd googled her boarding school tuition and the international student fees at Cambridge. I was unsurprised when she said her parents worked in finance. In the interval of the second play, I said something in passing about posh English people, and Edith said the concept of poshness didn't exist in Hong Kong. It was like Ireland. All money was new money. Rich was posh and posh was rich. Given that I was neither, I wasn't sure why I found that comforting, but I did. There wasn't even an upper-class accent, Edith said, although mainland Cantonese was sometimes regarded as sounding nicer. On each outing, she spouted facts at me. She used her hands when she talked, and often her whole body. To show me the regions of China, she scribbled on a napkin. I kept it. I liked her enthusiasm. I couldn't remember the last time I'd met someone who got excited about things. Each play, she had a different handbag. She managed this by putting the same abundantly pocketed travel case inside them all, so that the outer bag on any given day was just a shell. The designer bags cost thousands of Hong Kong dollars, and the travel case was maybe 100, and the latter was where she actually kept her things. I'd never understand rich people. Edith's keys, octopus card and wallet all lived in a given crevice, so that she could quickly locate them. This I admired and tried to implement in my own life. But I would choose bad places for things to live, forget they lived there, and still not be able to find them. When I closed shop with Joan before seeing the third play, she asked what I was up to. I said, "Off to the theatre." Joan's face said, "I'm clearly paying you too much." And Joan's mouth said, "Enjoy." My days off were Sunday and Monday. In the staff room, I complained with everyone else that working on Saturdays was killing my social life, but I didn't have one. That was fine. I liked having space to think. Besides, the rush hour train served for company. I settled in under a man's armpit, felt the stud of a woman's handbag digging into me, and thought, I am a part of something. Weekends were harder. The flat was louder without Julian. The taps dripped like waterboards, and the neighbours argued next door. Some mornings I didn't leave the bed because then I'd have to brush my teeth, followed by a series of actions that amounted to living my life as the person I was. I was unable to drum up positivity about either dental hygiene or the rest of my day. So I told myself I was disgusting and lazy, and I'd be late and they'd fire me. And then I got up. If you were really sick, you couldn't just harness your self-loathing like that, so I knew I was fine. And Edith was becoming something to look forward to. Chapter 19. The Sunday after my third theatre date with Edith, I went to see Miles at his flat in Kennedytown. Julian had asked me to. I suspected he wanted to make sure I was getting out of the flat, since he'd never gone much himself. But it would have been childish to tell him I knew what he was up to. The main room in Miles's flat was painted mustard and stuffed with clashing furniture. For an academic's home, there weren't many books. I guessed from the Kindle on the table that he was moving with the times. We talked about his university, and then how it compared to where I'd gone. Miles said Julian had told him I'd got a very good first indeed, and asked if I'd thought about academia. It seems interesting, I said, but I don't know what I'd write about. I couldn't tell if Miles was quoting or paraphrasing the very indeed construction. Julian sometimes went sarcastically antiquated, which showed he meant what he was saying, or he wouldn't bother sounding like he didn't. Miles, though, might say very indeed quite naturally. My degree was a fact, being a number, and Julian's opinion couldn't change its value. But I often thought about things that were silly to think about. Is your book going well? I said.
No, Miles said, but it's never going well.
He asked if Sudoku interested me, and said he had a book of puzzles if it did. We played in silence. Soon I got bored and sharpened his pencils. He kept them in a box on the table.
You're a gem, he said. Julian's done well for himself.
It was the most explicitly Miles had ever alluded to the relationship. I felt shortchanged that my lead-whittling abilities had triggered this acknowledgement. Then I wondered if I'd really just come to add texture to dinner with Florence, to see if Miles mentioned anything about her taste in decor, for instance. This seemed depressing, it's true. If I was stockpiling curlicues for Florence evenings while doing nothing to improve my real situation, it would mean I cared more about my interior life than the tangible one. Julian didn't daydream, and thus was off in London with a real job, while I was a teffel waster. Though he read so much that maybe he did have an imagination and was just better at controlling it. I'd never know if other people were as graphic as me in their daydreams, and we all just pretended we weren't. I'd once Googled, what do serial killers think about? There was surprisingly little overlap, but I hid my thoughts anyway. The more I imagined things, the more personal they felt.
It can be challenging making friends when you first moved here,
Miles said, snapping me out of it.
A lot of my exchange students find it quite isolating.
I have one or two, I said. I thought, one here, one there. The word friend did Herculean work in terms of describing me and Julian. And now I had another friend. A new class of 10-year-olds started on Tuesday. To break the ice, I asked why they wanted to learn English. They looked at each other across a room so small they could barely pull out the chairs and seemed unsure that the premise held. Lydia Tam introduced herself, then said, my Chinese name is, before another girl dug her in the ribs and said she couldn't give it here. Their motives for studying English were, from most to least commonly cited, school, travel, to watch movies, and to talk to me. This last was from Denise Chan, a lick arse, but you couldn't call your students that. Next came Fergus Wong, who wanted to learn English because everything had an English name as well as a Cantonese one. "You're crazy," said Denise. This seemed to be what Hong Kongese 10-year-olds said to someone when they didn't understand what they meant. I hated wielding authority. The kids could tell that and responded poorly whenever I tried. So I let them talk and thought, Edith Zhang, Zhang Meiling, Edith Zhang Meiling. I said the words to myself like I was unwrapping something. Chapter 20. April. When Julian had been gone just over a month, Edith and I went to Cinema City JP on Patterson Street. The movie was dubbed badly in Cantonese. We knew what would happen before the opening credits. Edith liked that. Formulaic plots were easier to follow while she edited documents on her iPad. We sat away from everyone else, the film started, and her keyboard clacked like chattering teeth. She didn't tell me how much her firm paid her, but I guessed it was a lot. The following week we went for coffee in Shang Wan. In the queue, Edith told me she liked how I'd done my hair. I was momentarily happy, but then she complimented the barista in the same animated way. "Tell me about your family," she said at the table, as if fascinated that I had one. I did. In return, she told me her father was from Hunan province in mainland China. Her mom was Singaporean. She only considered herself Hongki in that she'd grown up there, and even then she was born abroad. Her mom had nipped over to Toronto to get Edith a Canadian passport, a trek Mrs. Zhang regularly invoked for maternal leverage. She'd remind Edith that she flew while so pregnant she could barely walk, and without Edith's father there, all to get her daughter a document that would make it easier to one day leave her. In Mr. Zhang's defence, he had planned to be present at Edith's birth, but had missed his flight. Mrs. Zhang almost named Edith Toronto to commemorate the affair. Mr. Zhang convinced her it was gauche. The only way Mr. Zhang could turn Mrs. Zhang's mind against a given course of action was by convincing her it was gauche. "If I'm making my family sound really quite something," Edith said, "that's because they're really quite something." We'd known each other 4 weeks at that point, but it felt like longer. She said she fancied a pastry and queued up to get one. I watched her from the table. Edith disliked waiting, but liked the order of queues. I saw from her tactfully impatient expression that she was doing her best to reconcile these stances. She was such a polished and resolute individual that tiny breeches stood out. Stray thread on a skirt, wisps where hairline met back of neck. Before I met her, I'd wondered if uncouth meant uncouth, then what did couth mean? And now I knew. Couth meant Edith. That day, I realised I didn't care what anyone else thought. We could be thrown out of the cafe, and I would think it just showed that they did not recognise genius. Alone in bed that night, I googled her. She was a trainee solicitor, and her headshot was on the firm's website. There was a video underneath where she told prospective applicants that if she had to pick one thing, just one thing, that she loved most about work, it had to be the people. Her hair was in loose curls that bounced when she moved her chin. She nodded out her enthusiasms. The culture, nod. The ignition, nod. The fettle, nod. The elan. Such was corporate law. I envied her conviction and wondered if this was because I wanted to feel better about my own job. Then I checked my phone. She'd just followed me on Instagram. When you followed someone first, you knew they would click on your name to see if they should follow back. And of course they saw her pictures when I did that. I wasn't strictly obliged to keep scrolling and flick to the ones she was tagged in, but it was expected behaviour. The next day, Victoria mined me about Julian in a French tea room with striped upholstery. She thumbed the quilting of her Chanel bag, the squares threaded in penitential lines, and she dug. questions. I'd known she wanted him since she told me when drunk, but I couldn't gauge if her sober self realized how transparent she was being. More curious still, I played along. I wanted nuggets about Edith, and Victoria gave me them.
How have you been, Ava?
Victoria said, stressing the auxiliary so I'd know she didn't care. Fantastic, I said, hitting the middle syllable to remind her I was thriving specifically in Julian's apartment. It's been so long. Vowels elongated to clarify, in case I'd been too subtle, that I lived there and she didn't.
Your hair looks lovely, Victoria said. I should cut it.
Have you cut it? Victoria saloned monthly, but kindly remembered to ask, as though for me it was a triennial treat, when to her it was a basic living expense, conveying the latter too, though, since we had to be honest about these things. Women are good at talking. Menu, linen paper. The teas were in French, English and Chinese, in that order. Victoria ordered the thé au citron. Her slight mispronunciation of citron presented a quandary. I could order it too and say it properly. I wouldn't if she'd really butchered it, since that would be crass, but a slight difference would prickle her without letting her feel cathartically wronged. Alternatively, I could ask for lemon tea and make her feel gaudy for having used French in the first place. I would read out the English, then meet her eye. My niveau de français is between me and God. I could also just order a different tea, as I'd planned to before she said thé au citron wrong, but that was no fun. The lemon tea, I said. Then, waiting long enough that it was plausible the waiter was confused, but not so long he'd obviously already understood. Sorry, the thé au citron. Men weren't all I could do. The waiter brought our tea with a military step. Victoria asked when Julian was back. I said I didn't know. Normally, I wouldn't have admitted that. I would have implied I knew, but was only authorized to share it with our very closest friends. But I wanted it settled, so we could get to Edith. From this implied level of communication with Julian, Victoria could gather I also didn't know if he was sleeping with other people in London, or indeed in Hong Kong. Whether Julian had multiple women on the go was in any case too ambiguous for her purposes. If he didn't, that might indicate he was, of all things to picture him saying, a one-woman man. If he did, his bandwidth might be full, between the side hustles and the regular Irish. Gobbets about Julian without clear implications did not interest Victoria. She was businesslike in this. If she could have offered him money to have sex with her, I knew she would. Equally, she wouldn't go near him if he accepted. Next, Edith. She and Victoria were only acquaintances. No boyfriend, to Victoria's knowledge. Back in Hong Kong from England a little over a year. Just finished the PCLL. Now on her training contract. Victoria was an associate. I hadn't asked Victoria if she outranked Edith, but Victoria thought I ought to know. Most of Edith's friends were from boarding school, Cambridge and law, and so, functionally, had money. Victoria didn't clarify, functionally, since it was unimportant to Victoria whether someone cultivated a circle of rich people or just found themselves in one, but I supplied it myself. None of this was news, but I still liked hearing it. It was obvious why Victoria wanted to know about Julian, and much less apparent why I was grilling her on Edith. Victoria, too, would be puzzled if she considered it. But she had a pit viper's brain. She saw not by looking, but by rendering images of prey. She noticed all of Julian and the parts of me that pertained to him, and the rest she ignored. If interested in Victoria, Julian would undoubtedly have some take about monogamy being contractual and the cheating element therefore being her and Rafe's problem. Going on precedent, Julian showed attraction by purchasing gifts and being inadvertently rude about your background, neither of which I'd seen him do to her. Anyway, I hated her, felt ill picturing them together, and told myself my information made no difference, so I could trade it for facts about Edith. We split the bill. English has a subjunctive. I learnt that fact the morning I taught it. I knew French had one and suspected Irish did, but hadn't noticed its moody fingerprints on my native language. It turned out I didn't know because the English subjunctive required phrasing I would never use. Apparently, you didn't say, "What if I was attracted to her?" You said, "What if I were?" You deployed the subjunctive for the less than factual. If I avoided it, did that mean I only said true things? Or since I didn't section off the imaginary, perhaps everything I said was just a wish or a feeling. And maybe I sounded stupid for not knowing grammar. I wondered if Edith had been fighting the urge to correct me. "What's the difference?" asked Kenny Chan. I wasn't confident of it myself, so I read slowly from the textbook, then rephrased until they pretended to understand. But Sybil Fu got all the exercises right. She wouldn't have a few months ago. I knew it had nothing to do with me, and everything to do with the fact that her parents literally paid her for getting good results. But it still made me happy. I'd discovered that as well as her main Instagram account, Edith had one for her art. There were no references to it on the one she'd followed me from, but her friend Heidi had tagged in it a post she'd made a year ago. Heidi had gone to boarding school with Edith, which was a normal thing for me to know, because Edith had mentioned this in a comment that had come up on my newsfeed. My clicking Heidi's name and going through her posts was less obviously the algorithm's fault. On the art account, Edith posted pencil sketches of buildings. Her scratchy, cross-hatch style surprised me, but you could tell it was her from the odd, careful detail. She was good. This came as some relief. I'd found the journals Julian had written poetry for at Oxford, but hadn't dug further because I was worried the poems would be bad and I'd have to keep living in his apartment. Edith's personal account was also an aesthetic triumph. The images were cool-toned and slightly faded, just enough to give reality a glaze. Her posts were like clues. Here is some Edith, and some more over here, and an entire Edith somewhere beyond the squares. The things in the pictures obsessed me. The vintage gold-plate watch. The brown Saffiano iPhone folio case. The jade bracelet. I wanted her life. I worried this might endanger our friendship, but so far it seemed to be facilitating it. Because she was richer and more important than me, I had an out from the suspicion that I was in fact her lesser on intellectual or moral grounds. She answered her phone or tapped at something on her iPad, and I thought, everyone else wants a piece of her, and here she is with me. This was stupid, because when Julian had done that, I'd just resented him for not paying me attention. And I'd known him far longer than a month. Probably I was a bad person and could not correctly process emotions. My collarbone was a comfort. I could find myself otherwise grotesque and still trace the lines in front of the mirror, thinking, this is sexy. This I would fancy if I were Edith, and if I, Edith, liked women. Chapter 21. Edith and I were now hanging out a few times a week, but I had no idea why she spent time with me, let alone why she liked me. I suppose I was of anthropological interest. She'd ask why I didn't just do things. Why, she'd say, didn't I just check the weather before leaving the house, or just use an app for this or that? And she found it fascinating when I said I hadn't thought of it. Nothing escaped her. At a brunch place, she referenced my not liking cheese. And when I asked how she knew that, she said I'd told her a few weeks ago. I never admitted to remembering things people had told me in passing, but I knew that this trait, which made Edith look frank and organized, would only make me seem like I didn't get out enough. "You need to read the news," she said over coffee. "We can't even choose our own candidates, and I read the news." I wanted to tell her I'd known about Hong Kong's government, then remembered I only knew it because Julian had mentioned it the first time we met Miles. I tried to see myself as she did when I dressed myself or bought things. The day before a cinema trip, I spent 400 Hong Kong dollars on a Jo Malone candle because I could imagine lighting it with her in the flat. For her, I'd burn a candle worth 4 hours' pay to me, i.e. 1/6 of a day, thinking, the other 5/6 are there too, if you want them. It would glow purple against her face, and her cheekbones would ridge like sand ripples. She'd say I had good taste, and I'd say, no, you. We'd both be right, because no one with discernment could spend that much time with another who lacked it. We both had it, or neither did, and I didn't care which. This made me realize I didn't actually care about refinement and just wanted Edith to like me. At first, that made me happy, since earning her approval seemed more attainable than developing style. Then I remembered that Edith was not like most people. I noticed more and more how much attention she paid to details. We went back again for lattes in Sheng Wan, and she flinched when I sipped mine before she had taken a photo. Then she reconsidered the still life before her and said, actually, the lipstick stain is perfect. I hadn't noticed I'd left one. Another day we got croissants and she said something in Cantonese, then translated, camera eats first, as I made to pick mine up. That made me smile. I liked when she was unapologetically earnest about things, even if it was the angle of a pastry. She said Instagram made her look at everything more closely. Whenever she felt sad, she had a wall of happy memories to look back on. I know it's all very silly, she said, but it's fun. I tried to imagine Julian admitting he enjoyed something frivolous, and couldn't. Besides, she wouldn't have said that the first month we met. I felt I was making progress, though I wasn't sure what towards. I wished I could watch her be friends with other women. If I knew how she normally went about it, it would be easier to know if we were different. We laughed a lot in the cinema, especially at the films about sad straight boys who needed fixing. Women in movies taught men how to feel things. They took men who felt nothing and made them feel something. You could never tell what those women felt themselves, besides, I want to help this man. I'd never met anyone like that in real life. I'd never met anyone like Edith either, and was grateful not to have many other people competing with her for my time. My Hong Kong existence was neat. It had space for her. Besides, there was room in me. I felt superior to people like Scott and Madison, but really the three of us were hollow. They filled themselves with a little bit of everyone's approval, whereas I was more discerning. When I met someone I liked, I wanted all of them, and fast. I started going to supermarkets a lot, mostly Welcome and 7-Eleven trips. The walls were papered in adverts. The greying tiles bore boot marks and hairs set in mud. When I went at rush hour, the cashier queues stretched down the aisles, and I'd take my place at the end and take things off shelves as I advanced. If you shuffled past your noodles or cereal or whatever, you couldn't go back or you'd lose your place in the line. I liked pretending this was the highest risk transaction I participated in, and that my life was well rooted aside from this one thing about the supermarket. When Julian was around, I'd committed to nutritionally sound shopping baskets. Now it was his second month away. I bought Pocky sticks and matcha Kit Kats. The packets listed ingredients I couldn't pronounce. I puzzled them out by breaking down the syllables like I made students do with names of dinosaurs. On the weekends that I didn't see Edith or Miles, the convenience store staff were the only people I spoke to. I made myself nice for them. I put on lipstick. At the counter, an old lady with cropped hair turned to a colleague and said, Gui Muya. In Cantonese, white people were ghosts. In Hokkien, Edith had told me over coffee we were redheads, and in Mandarin, old friends. The latter, she'd said, is certainly one reading of Sino-Western relations. In Russia, Edith had said, you could get Putin's face on anything. Vodka, bread, you name it. In Hong Kong, the same was true of Hello Kitty. This was, Edith said, in part because Hello Kitty came from Japan, and so betokened resistance to mainland China. A vending machine in her apartment lobby stocked Hello Kitty toy pianos and candy dispensers. There were also Hello Kitty tampons, though she was less certain what they stood for. I'd noticed she'd started talking more often about periods, also exfoliation and core tightening exercises. I knew these were normal things for friends to discuss, but the thought came to me unbidden. Maybe Edith wants me to notice her body. One Sunday in mid-April, Victoria bumped into me leaving 7-Eleven and asked how I stayed thin, if that was what I ate. I strive for balance, I said, which meant I sometimes had a Hello Kitty donut for breakfast and then felt so sick I ate nothing else all day. Balance, Victoria said, is key. I agreed. The following week she saw me there again. I recalled she lived nearby. We were both drunk. She asked what was wrong with me. I said nothing was wrong with me, that something was wrong with her, and also, while I was here, and with reference to her previous query, that I was thin because I had money. The next time we saw each other, we pretended this exchange had not occurred. I could say whatever I wanted now. Edith was still always the one who suggested meeting up. I didn't dare. Her time, like Julian's, was important. I'd pretend I couldn't do the first day she proposed, but she'd say it was her only one free. If she posted no evidence of her hectic life, I thought, she said she was busy. When she did post, I thought, not too busy for Instagram. The other teachers invited me to TST. First, we went to a speakeasy bar that was authentically local. Scott from Arkansas said he knew because another American had told him. There was no website or contact number, but Scott got us there by finding the 7-Eleven on Kimberley Road and looking for the back door with a pig's head peeking out. I went to the toilet. The girl in the next cubicle was crying or coming. I wasn't sure. Edith always posted stories on Friday nights. Sure enough, from 9 p.m. there was a pile of folders in the office captioned, "My life is fun and interesting," followed an hour later by an overhead of cocktails with, "Liquor cures all workloads." I considered the possibility that the girl was both crying and coming, and felt her night was going better than mine, regardless. Too late, I remembered that I'd have to post something now, or Edith would see I'd viewed her story and think I was at home on my phone. I went back out and roped Bryony from Leeds into a selfie. She'd taken too much MDMA to question this behaviour. 20 minutes later, I checked the list and saw Edith had seen it. Soon enough, the rainbow circle appeared around Edith's name to show she'd put another picture up. I didn't check it. This felt like a minor victory. The following Monday, we got coffee in Shung Wan, and Edith said she was working on an IPO, initial public offering, she clarified. I knew that from Julian, but appreciated the thought. The partner helming it, William Brent, had been in Hong Kong since before the handover. He said men were scared of women now. I'm not sure, Edith said. If he's scared he'll grope us, or scared we'll tell HR. She felt it had been easy at Cambridge to claim we should take unfeminist spaces and reform them. Harder in real life, she found. You couldn't quite announce to William Brent that the space of his law firm was presently unfeminist. Not least because the first step to changing it would be expunging William Brent. Edith was calm about things she couldn't change. Her firm was full of horrible men and she had to be nice to them. You did in every job, and at least hers paid well. I was sure there were William Brents at Julian's bank, and that he took about as much action as he had when Seb commented on the dimensions of my throat. Undoubtedly, he told himself he'd do something once he had the power, and when he got there, he'd wonder where all the women had gone. I still hadn't told Edith about Julian. Probably I was putting it off, because I knew she wouldn't like the sound of him. I wanted to say she didn't know him like I did. That was a textbook claim women made about men we'd regret. The men are the claim, depending on how you parsed it. But it was undeniably true when Edith and Julian had never met. You really don't like men, I said. You're right, I don't. This, too, was ripe for parsing. I told Edith about a summer in college when a few of us had gone to someone's holiday home in West Cork. I slept on the couch. Two of the lads took a mattress on the floor. And in the dark, one of them came and lay on top of me, calmly, as if instructed to. I whispered I wasn't sure, which meant get off but I'm scared what you'll do if I say that. And he ignored me. His breath tanged of alcohol. I thought it was Colm, but it might have been Ferdia. I couldn't see. Probably I could have deduced Ferdia or Colm, but I didn't, because then I'd know. And then for all subsequent interactions with either Colm or Ferdia, which I'd have to keep having because no one would believe me, or they'd say, yeah, but he's his own problems, I'd remember what he did. No, his own memory of events was that we'd got drunk and hooked up, and be certain, too, that our friends would not take sides, i.e. treat me like someone who might be lying about rape. I told myself what they'd say. Grey area. I just don't think he'd do that. And soon became convinced I was actually making it up. Then felt like a sick, amoral person for falsely accusing someone of something that I hadn't accused him of and that he had, in fact, done. Fuck, said Edith. Yeah. You could tell who'd been through it and who hadn't, because when you told someone who hadn't, they were hungry for details. They'd say it was so they could experience their moral outrage with a loftier precision. They were liars, and we hated them. Edith and I said as much as we wanted to. When we were done, we changed the subject. One day I realized we'd stopped seeing plays. I asked why, and Edith said she didn't really like theatre. I wanted you to think I did, she said, and then went back to her phone. This surprised me on a few levels. I hadn't known she cared about making me think she was cultured. I hadn't realized I came across as someone who set store by that kind of thing. And I hadn't noticed our relationship changing such that she could now be honest with me, if this latest confession was what she really felt, and not some new illusion of candor. Julian, I thought, can tell when people like him. He and Edith had many skills in common. I wondered if this was one of them. I started drafting a message where I told Julian about Edith. I've made a new friend. I don't know why I'm only telling you now. I've only known her a few weeks, but I'm thinking about her more and more. Incidentally, the search term, how to flirt with women, returns very different results to how to tell a woman is flirting with you. In both cases, the researcher is assumed to be male. I'm guessing you don't mind when things assume you're male, which might explain your love of literature. I've never had sex with a woman anyway. I kissed a few in college. Their lips are softer, if you didn't know. I think about sleeping with other people, and then I feel guilty, which is weird. You see, I think, if anything, you'd be amused if I didn't have sex with someone for your sake. Like, oh, you shouldn't have, it's too much. I was scared when you left, but I don't think anything has changed. You still put more time and energy into showing you don't love me than anyone has ever put into showing me they do. Sometimes I love you, and sometimes I think it would be best if a plane flew into your office and you were on the plane or in the building. I decided, on balance, that this message would not have the propitiatory effect intended. Chapter 22. My primary four kids were writing haikus, 5 syllables, then 7, then 5. The previous term they'd done 4-line poems, and Ming Chun Lai expressed a certain suspicion that this meant the curriculum was becoming easier, not harder. We argued over certain words. They held, for instance, that film had 2 syllables, film. I wanted to say most of Dublin agreed, but their parents weren't paying for Dublin English. Katie Cheng, 9, disliked the haiku format. Together we brainstormed for her to write a poem about a cat. For the first line, she said, "The big hairy cat liked to drink lots and lots of milk." I offered 5-syllable versions. My cat likes its milk. The cat likes drinking. Milk's my cat's favourite. Whether favourite had 2 syllables or 3 was a box Pandora herself would have left well enough alone at that particular juncture. Katie Cheng wasn't assuaged. Katie Cheng wanted it all in the first line. I asked what she'd put in the second if she'd said everything in the first, and she said she'd think of more. I told her she could write a story. but to at least use paragraphs. She acceded to this with great reluctance. There still wouldn't be room, she said. I'd been a pliable child, and I wondered if it was obvious, even then, that I would never be an artist. If a teacher had told me to put in line breaks, I'd have sliced up my words like ham in order to please them. Mam told me Dublin was hot for April. Next the Arctic will melt, she said, and we'll be living in bunkers. I said I hoped there'd be intermediary stages. She said Dad said hi. I said she meant Dad told her to say hi. Dad says hi implied he was saying it himself. Mam told me there was no need to be difficult, and that George said hi too. Then she had news. My cousin Tighe's landlady had evicted him, purportedly to move in a family member, but the room had gone on daft a week later with a €100 hike in the rent. I'd forgotten about Tighe. Another cousin had had a baby. I told Mam I didn't recognise the name, and she repeated, Sinead, as though this alone would acquaint me with her. You're far away, she said, which felt unfair inasmuch as I hadn't known Sinead before I'd left either. Mam, I said, did you think about giving us Irish names? She said no, that people who did that sent their kids to tin whistle classes. And Rachel Mulvey's back, she said. I didn't know Rachel Mulvey either. Mam specified, the Mulveys down the road, in a tone conveying, it is now obvious to me that my daughter knows nothing. Back from New York, Mam said. They all come back, sooner or later. She added that the house felt empty without me and Tom. It's a waste giving money to a landlord. Tom said 800's a good deal. 800 a month. For one room, Ava. It's wrong, I said, when people earn money for owning houses they don't use. I think we should take their houses off them. Daydreaming again, Mam said. Ringing home made me miss discussing politics openly. I couldn't at work, not least because Joan and Benny were both landlords on the side, but more fundamentally because bosses did not like to employ people who thought they should not exist. Julian listened but was incapable of going, that's an interesting thought. He'd swipe at anything dangled before him. With Edith and Miles, I could be as left-wing as I wanted, but I worried about how to sound clever. I said, the state should seize all the hotels in Dublin and turn them into social housing.
Ah, no, Ava.
And there should be a 100% inheritance tax and universal basic income.
Ah, no.
And eventually, communism.
Ah, no.
I enjoyed conversations where I wasn't attempting to persuade anyone, where I just said precisely what I thought. I got tired of making myself acceptable. Mam started asking a lot of questions. She did that when she could tell I was holding something back. But there was nothing worth telling her about Edith. If I said I'd been getting coffee with a woman, Mam would just wonder what I was really hiding. Chapter 23. Later in April, Edith and I went to an art exhibition in Shung Wan. She greeted me with a hug. I was afraid I'd get something on her clothes, a piece of fluff or a stray hair. Nice dress, she said. You look like Audrey Hepburn. It's old, I said. It's lovely. She seemed to think I couldn't take compliments. I preferred to believe I disliked profuse displays of emotion, and would accept any amount of praise if people tempered themselves in how they expressed it. On the walk over, I wondered if Edith was pretty, or if I just found her so. I was aware, with my college head on me, that beauty was subjective. But I wanted to know if we were aesthetically matched. I nearly asked if she knew Holly Golightly was bisexual. Having formulated the remark and decided how I'd orchestrate my body language while making it, I blushed nearly as much as I would if I'd actually said it. Lumpish children ran through the gallery. The paintings were of tulips and cherry blossoms. Edith claimed it was the kind of thing her grandma liked. I thought she'd said that to make fun of the exhibition. But then she went to buy prints for the very same grandma. It was at moments like this I remembered there was a category of people who called her Mei Ling and whom I'd never meet. As we left, I told Edith I'd go home and make dinner. She asked if I had flatmates. I'd been wondering when she'd raise that. One, I said, but he's away. Julian. Julian, she said, vigilantly, I thought. Maybe we could cook together. I'd never brought guests to the apartment and was relieved there was no tiresome process of registering them at the lobby. The rule was that you should, but it turned out to be one the doormen did not apply to white people. In the lift, a woman held a panting German shepherd on a lead. Edith said something, gow, something, and the woman laughed and said something, something, gow. You sure Julian doesn't mind? Edith said. I felt I had told her something personal by giving his name and wondered, stupidly, if it was too late to take it back. Inside the door, I put my ballet flats on the bottom shelf, then moved them to the top unnecessarily, which struck me as the behaviour of a nervous person. While Edith cooked, I lit the candles for the first time ever. I wondered if Julian would notice the globs of wax when he returned. Edith took Julian's wingback chair after it became clear I'd forgotten I was meant to invite her to. She used the armrests. Julian rarely did when he sat there. He'd crossed his arms narrowly, like he was in the middle seat on a plane, and the people on either side of him had boarded first. We ate. I asked why Edith didn't move out. It would have been a stupid question for most Hong Kongese 20-somethings, but I knew she made plenty of money. You can't just move out, she said. You need a husband, or at least a mortgage. Do you think you'll get married? No, I don't suppose I will. We should just get a house together. Edith smiled and said, maybe. I gave her the remote, and she chose a channel showing Inglourious Basterds. She said the title was spelled that way because Tarantino had misspelled it in a leaked screenplay, and then insisted he'd done it on purpose. We agreed this was extremely male. I touched my mouth a lot when we talked. It was a childish habit and made me look gormless. I made myself stop, then found I was playing with my hair. During a shootout, Edith asked what Julian was like. It did not seem strictly necessary for her to keep using his name. He's in London right now, I said. He's in banking. I considered alternative phrasings. He does banking. He works in a bank. He works for a bank. Edith probably thought they were all the same, but maybe she didn't, and I'd used the wrong one. I sometimes thought things might have gone better with Julian if I'd known you went up to Oxford. I hated the British class system. That was definitely a front for whatever the hell I was actually feeling in the context of Edith. But it was also a real emotion. Just not the main one. By my standards, I was being self-aware. I knew Julian still wouldn't be my boyfriend if I'd said up, but on some level, I earnestly believed that my key uncertainty with Edith was whether she experienced attraction towards people who misuse the subjunctive. Do your parents find it weird, Edith said, that you're living with a man? I haven't told them. They wouldn't get it. Which was true. Does he bring girls back? She said. She was typing on her phone while she said it. I knew she really did have emails to answer, but I also wondered if it wasn't a touch convenient that she always saw to them when she was saying something potentially awkward. I wished I'd said at the start that Julian and I were fucking. It was too late now. Edith would stop telling me things and would be newly suspicious of anything I told her. Looking at her, I could see she'd suit Julian. They both kept tempo to hard shoes on marble floors, Sunday phone calls and midnight emails. They could save time if one read The Economist and the other the FT, and then they pooled facts. I was sure if I put all this on a spreadsheet, Julian would ask Edith out. I pictured them together, then realized I was only doing so because I couldn't form a clear image of her and me. My hand could pass as Edith's much more easily than as Julian's in the dark. But there were only so many thoughts you could productively entertain. The film ended, and Edith said she'd have to go soon. We should do this again sometime, she said.
It might be harder when Julian's back.
He's not a mingler?
I said he was about as close to being Catherine the Great of Russia.
This joke was a lot like one of Julian's, and wasn't much like mine. I wondered if I'd stolen his phraseology because it had worked on me. Before Edith left, I showed her my wardrobe. She pulled out a camel coat and said she loved Ted Baker because it looked more expensive than it was. I had moved on so far from the version of myself who'd found the price alarming that I was only embarrassed on their behalf.
By the way, Ava, she said, are you a communist?
No one had asked me that before. At college, people had assumed I was, since all my friends were, and no one at work thought an adult could be.
Yes, I said.
Edith said she saw the merits of it, but also liked having nice things. The next day, I messaged saying, you could argue Marxism means thinking everyone should have nice things, including us.
Edith replied that I surely couldn't think it justified having a Rolex in the here and now, not when people were starving.
I said, you're right. I wanted to add that Julian's watch was a cheap one he'd got in Shanghai, but reflected that Edith did not know him and had made no apparent horological assumptions. Later that night, she messaged again, complaining about still being in the office. I sent her the PDF of Why Marx Was Right, with the subject heading, Warning, Marxist Polemic. She replied, are you hitting on me? Because I feel like this won't be safe for work. The lights were off. My hands were silhouettes in front of the screen. Ever since his departure 2 months ago, I'd been keeping tabs on Julian online. His social media presence was more of an absence. No status updates. Facebook profilers changed so infrequently that within 4 scrolls he was getting sprayed with champagne after finals. He had an Instagram where he'd posted 8 pictures ever. Since leaving for London, he'd taken to opening all my stories. I doubted he knew that it told you when someone did that. Edith's name was always near the top of my story viewers. In vain, I consulted articles and subreddits to see whether this meant she stalked me, I stalked her, or both. I already knew I checked her account a lot, but I wanted to know if the algorithm knew. More importantly, I wondered if I was high on Edith's list. If her coming high on mine did mean I was the stalker, then at least I would only come high on hers if she was stalking me too. And if her being high on mine made her the stalker, then yes, my being high on hers would out me as one. But she stalked me back and couldn't judge. I compared them. They were neither similar enough to be twins, nor different enough to be foils. Still, I kept one tab open on Edith, another on Julian, and went back and forth. Chapter 24. May. In early May, Edith took me to Times Square Mall. It was big and clean, with marble floors. The Lane Crawford department store took up the atrium, then Gucci and Chanel. China bait, Edith said. Then Lowe and Max Mara. Thinking man's China bait. Then labels for people who thought they had money but didn't. Your coaches, your Michael Kors.
Imagine wearing Michael Kors on purpose, Edith said.
I told her that was a bad thing to say.
It is true, though, she said.
Whenever I wore something Julian had bought me, I felt Edith could tell what it cost and did not think it was worth the money. We went to Zara. I asked why Zara was acceptable when Michael Kors was not, and Edith said it was because Zara knew who they were. She added that she was well aware on another level that this was all consumerist garbage. But Mrs. Zhang's influence was hard to shake off.
You're right, I said. It is consumerist garbage.
She smiled. I was glad she seemed to find my sullenness endearing, but suspected she only did because it did not much affect her. I pictured us as cartoon characters, me trying to headbutt her, stuck in the same spot with my forehead ramming into her serenely outheld palm.
At the racks, she chose things for us to try on. I was too embarrassed to check if we were the same size, but Edith asked mine and said we were. She said it would save time if we shared a changing room stall. I turned away, and then Edith did the same, like it wouldn't otherwise have occurred to her. Through the mirror, I saw her black lace bra. Her deodorant smelt like soap. "I like your freckles," she said, still with her back to me. She could have been admitting she'd glanced over her shoulder, or could simply have been commenting on the parts of me she'd already seen, and I felt it wouldn't have killed her to be clearer about that. "I like your dress," I said. "Mine is ugly." Edith said no, it was just different. It was the first time we'd disagreed on clothes. "The neckline brings out your collarbones," she said. I told her she had nice collarbones too. That wasn't it interesting we pluralized collarbones when it was really all one bone? And also that the dress was still ugly. "Let me try it on if you don't want it," she said. I took it off. This time I stayed facing her. Later, I started another Potemkin message to Julian. "I think I'm flirting with Edith. She seems like someone who flirts with everyone, and so doesn't really flirt with anyone. I don't know what's happening. I've known her 2 months, and it feels like she's the only person in my life who has ever mattered or existed." I highlighted the text and pressed the back key, then navigated out and back into my drafts 3 times to make sure the deletion had saved. In the now empty box, I wrote, "I wish I knew how I felt about everything." Then erased that too. Victoria invited me out for tea again, alluding to things Julian had written to her about. Writing just meant messaging, but made them sound in deeper cahoots. I replied that I was busy with work. I watched myself type this thing that would obviously make Victoria hate me even more than she already did, then kept watching as I pressed send. Mam also said it had been a while. When I called, she said I seemed distracted. Julian messaged, then again a few days later, saying, cockily, I thought, that it wasn't like me to take so long to reply. Even Tom asked if things were well. It was so long since we'd last spoken that I forgot to upbraid him for telling Mam about Julian. Whenever I was waiting for Edith's replies, I touched my collarbone. Then she'd message. The first Sunday of May, she and I went to a sushi place in Queensway. We met at the station and walked past money changers and double-decker trams on Hennessy Road. The Chinese pharmacies smelled of scallops and woody ginseng. Edith saw me looking at the display crates of brown shriveled remedies and said Mrs. Zhang had detailed thoughts on what worked and what didn't if I ever needed help. "Bird's nests for coughs," she said. I tried to jaywalk at a crossing, but she pulled me back. The sushi restaurant had a conveyor belt. I didn't eat fish, so my options were limited. Edith saw a cucumber roll before I did, jerked forward to grab it, then smiled in triumph at what a good provider she was. She rated me as an intermediate chopstick user. I wasn't embarrassing myself, but nor would I be winning prizes. When I couldn't follow her demonstration, she reached over and arranged the sticks in my hand. Afterwards, I was scared to put them down in case I couldn't reposition them at the correct angle. "How long do you think you'll stay in Hong Kong?" Edith said. "I don't know," I said. "Maybe till I want to get a mortgage?" "If you don't mind my saying," she said, "your flat is quite nice. Maybe you could move somewhere cheaper." "To be honest, Julian pays most of the rent." "Really?" she said. There was always surprise in Edith's voice. That was her charm. But it made it harder to tell when a statement had genuinely nonplussed her. She held her chin at just that angle and widened her eyes just so to take in words, any words. This face was one of my favourites of Edith's. But its ubiquity muddled matters when I'd told her something difficult and didn't know what to say next. "It's complicated," I said. "This is none of my business," she said. "But..."
"Are you wondering..."
"Yes." "No. but I don't mind you asking. I wondered if I was being dishonest to avoid hurting my, quote, chances with her, end quote. But I didn't think that was it. I was unscrupulous enough to lie so I could have sex with someone. But while I'd do other things just as bad, it wasn't the sort of bad thing I'd do. Unless, of course, I was telling myself that so I'd feel I was being duly self-critical while remaining fuzzy on which of my behaviours ever did count as the sort of bad thing I'd do. Also, I still didn't know Edith's sexuality. I thought about inventing an ex-girlfriend to see her reaction, but this felt beyond the pale. There was no limit to what I would trawl through online, and clearly none on the information I would hide from Edith. But I wouldn't make up a person. That was my moral purlieu. Coincidentally, bringing up a girlfriend would take courage, whereas cyberstalking was easy. There was the question of Julian, but he'd laughed at me back in February when I asked if he minded me flirting with men. Women, I assumed, were fair game. Even if they weren't, I knew I'd keep seeing Edith anyway. Chapter 25. I tried to keep seeing Miles, not least so I would have some way to account to Julian how I was spending my time. It also distracted me from thinking about Edith, which was nice, because then when I remembered her again, it felt better than the last time. Miles told me about how Mao heeded the failed Taiping rebellion in the mid-19th century. Like him, the Taipings imported a rebellious foreign doctrine. Unlike him, they never made it resonate with locals, and so were crushed by the gentry's grassroots militia.
"Another reason Marxist academia shouldn't be a universe unto itself," said Miles.
It was the fourth time I'd gone to see him since Julian's departure.
"And between us," he said, "it makes me question the purpose of what I do. Who reads academics' books?"
"I have to admit I don't," I said, absent-mindedly, but he laughed and said he could always count on me for brutal honesty. That wasn't true. I often lied to spare others' feelings, or to make them like me. Most of my directness was by accident. But I got more social capital from pretending it was on purpose, not least because it made people assume my compliments had to be sincere. Julian seemed to trust me. Smart people often did dumb things.
"Would you like tea?"
Miles said. I thought it was too hot for that, but said yes, then offered to make it myself. Miles declined twice and accepted the third time. The kitchenette had a window and poor soundproofing, so I heard and saw men in hats doing something with drills outside. Miles said he was coming to prefer my company to Julian's. I knew that wasn't true, but thanked him for saying it. I wondered if it was obvious how much I craved his son's approval, or if he thought everyone wanted Julian to like them. For some time, I'd been dying to ask him who'd come to Hong Kong first, father or son. I frequently pictured a conversation where one of them was already installed there, and then the other rang from England to announce they'd be moving over too. They'd both remain calm on the surface, but the exchange would have far-reaching emotional implications. Julian would say, "Right, a lot." I couldn't think of Julian for too long without cycling back to Edith. Most persons, places, and things led me her way, but Julian especially triggered it. I sat there in Miles's apartment and thought, "Edith," and smiled. "Drink faster, Irish," Edith said. "You know it's a serious social problem in Ireland." "Yeah, okay, sorry. Drink moderately." We'd picked up ladies' night champagne at a rooftop bar in LKF on a Friday in mid-May. The premise of the evening was that bars gave us free drinks, so we'd stay there for men to sleaze on. Edith said this made girl-on-girl dating quite affordable for the savvy consumer. I couldn't remember if most women made jokes like Edith's, or how their faces looked when they did make them. We were getting Mullard before Cyril Kwok's 23rd. Edith asked if Mullard meant what she thought it did. "Yes," I said. Irish English made sense. That was how one distinguished it from British English. Anyway, I said, why do we need to get Mullard?
You'll see, Edith said. Ermeshka is the Irish Irish.
Let's get Ermeshka, she said, as if deciding to keep it. The ladies' night champagne was a shoddy payment for talking to the men. Anything would be. They slapped the tables whenever anyone said anything, which seemed bizarrely to encourage them all to say more. You would need to drink a huge amount not to deliberately step on their foot, and the quality of the alcohol did not lend itself to this. We'd claimed wicker chairs in the corner. Edith drank 3 flutes of champagne in 10 minutes. I asked if she really needed that much sedation for Cyril Quox.
He Instagrams his friends' car keys, Edith said. They pile their keys on the coffee table, and he posts a picture and tags them.
As in, he tags them as their keys? I said. Edith rolled her eyes like, no, he tags them as the post-fact malaise.
It was my turn to top up our drinks.
And one for my friend? I said to the barman, enunciating sternly to tell him he could take from that just what he wanted.
Back at the rooftop, Edith was answering emails on her phone. I stood at a distance for some time, as though waiting for something to change. When I came and put the flutes on the table, I said, feeling I could if I was doing something else while saying it, that I wondered if women ever did use ladies' night for dates.
It's certainly a strategy, she said.
No one could be good at Edith. She hailed a taxi and swapped sentences with the driver in Cantonese. In the cab, I slipped my heels off and felt the carpet through my tights. Taxis always smell like new car, I said.
They use a spray, Edith said.
You know everything.
You're Ermeshka.
She stroked a ladder on my tights and said I should be more careful. I wondered if this was a simple extension of her domain over everything, or if I'd somehow indicated she was allowed. I'd said I was hers from how I looked at her, not from how I'd chosen to look at her, but from how I couldn't help looking at her. But that didn't mean she could tell. Maybe Edith didn't notice me at all, and touched me as she would a small appliance. The taxi dropped us uphill, and we passed 3 checkpoints through to a marble lobby with a 20-foot fig tree in the centre. There were potted bonsais on all surfaces, including one in the lift. Edith said having children was like growing bonsai. I asked what growing a full-size tree was like. That, Edith said, was a question of temperament. Cyril Quock met us at the door. He wore white from head to toe, sweatshirt, jeans, trainers.
Pick a colour, he said.
This is Ava, Edith said.
Hi, Ava. Pick a colour.
Pink, I said. Hi, Cyril.
Rosé it is.
The party was loud and dark, with flashing lights. Cyril led us through the atrium and up the mezzanine to what he called the bucket. I was relieved to see it was an actual bucket. He fished inside and found Edith a bottle of Armand de Brignac.
Happy me turning 23, he said,
kissing cheeks before excusing himself. I told Edith he seemed nice and asked why she hated him. She didn't hear me the first time, so I had to say it into her ear.
I thought you'd judge me for liking him, she said. He went to Eton.
Julian went to Eton, I said.
Edith gripped the rosé as though to remind me she held the talking stick.
You always bring up Julian, she said.
I hadn't been sure she was drunk until then.
You shouldn't pretend you hate your friends, I said.
The noise drowned me out again, and Edith asked me to repeat myself, which let me redraft it to,
sorry I made you feel like you have to pretend to hate your friends.